It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
What's up, everyone? Welcome back to the Midwest Madness Podcast, your home for men's and women's Big 12 hoops. I'm your host, Christine Butterfield, and it's just going to be me again today. Had a couple of scheduling conflicts happen and was unable to just make any last-minute changes. So just going to be me updating you on what happened this weekend, what to look out for, and really talking about teams that are now starting to distinguish themselves in the Big 12, teams that are taking that leap forward and really making themselves or their presence known in the Big 12. And we're now starting to see, like, you know, in the first few weeks, you really start to see players and teams dogpiling each other. You know, different teams are beating different teams, and there's no real structure to the conference. And you're seeing all these messy wins, all these bad losses, and then sometimes, you know, really, really big wins. But for the first few weeks of the Big 12, it's always hard to discern which basketball teams are kind of over the other until about mid-February or so, where teams finally start to hit their stride in either a positive way or you see that teams are overhyped in a negative way. So we're going to get into all of that today. And I'm going to begin with the ugliest game of the weekend because I just want to get it over with. This game was awful to watch. Like, I was watching this Bedlam game, and y'all, I don't mean to offend any Cowboys fans or any Sooner fans listening to this, but this was just gross, okay? You ain't got no alibi, you ugly. Like, this was not a good game by any means necessary. It was just ugly from the beginning basically to the end. There was a lot of scoring droughts throughout the game, and this isn't something that is a regular for this Oklahoma team because they're just not a strong shooting team. Definitely not from the perimeter. And this game especially, they shot terrible from behind the arc. They finished 10% from there and Oklahoma State finished 20%. And so even though they shot a higher percentage from there, Oklahoma actually made more threes than they did. They just missed a lot more. So, you know, it was just tough. It was tough, and it was tough to watch. Oklahoma State and Oklahoma kind of went on their own runs, respectively, throughout the game. Throughout the first half, it was pretty manageable. Oklahoma would go on their small run. There was a scoring drought of about 5 or 6 minutes at one point, and then Oklahoma State would go on their runs, and at one point, it was 26-26 even in the first half. Then Oklahoma State led 29-28, so stayed pretty even until the second half happened. And Oklahoma State went on a bit of a run in the beginning. Oklahoma made a shot. Harkless made literally a coast-to-coast play to begin the half, and then they did not score for another 4 minutes. And they had 7 turnovers in 7 minutes, which when you average out those times, you assume, okay, like these possessions are probably lasting around 30 seconds. That means that practically every single possession they had for the next 7 minutes resulted in some kind of a turnover, which is just unbelievable. And on top of that, the only two players that showed up for Oklahoma basically were Tanner Groves and Elijah Harkless. This was Elijah Harkless's first game back in the starting lineup for Oklahoma. And you could see exactly why they were missing him. First of all, his defensive presence is almost second to none in the Big 12. He got 5 steals this game, which is incredible. He's just so active on the defensive end. I don't want to say he's a bully, but he's just a gnat, you know? Like, he's just going to be in your face the whole time, annoying you. And that's the kind of defender you want on your team. And then on the plus side of that, he had 15 points on the offensive end, finishing 6 of 12. So he was a 50% shooter, and he made 2 threes back-to-back to begin the half. So he was really the one of the key players for Oklahoma, getting them on the board. Yes, he had 8 turnovers, which is high, but you look at the fact that basically no other teammate besides Tanner Groves was getting anything else done. I guess you'll welcome those turnovers, because half the time he ended up just getting the ball back on the defensive end anyways. So he was able to kind of net those outcomes. Tanner Groves was the other leading scorer, and he led both teams with 23 points on 10 of 17 shooting, which is incredible. He was 50% from the perimeter, had 9 rebounds, so almost had a double-double there, and he was on fire. Everyone else from Oklahoma was dead. No one else was getting anything done. The bench only provided 10 points, while Oklahoma State's bench recorded 26 points. They really had a really good rounded out roster playing in this game. Every player was getting something done and helping the team out in a positive way. And the only two players that had only a few minutes was Moncrief and Newton. And everybody else had double digits in minutes, and they were providing something positive. You also had 4 players for Oklahoma State that were in double figures. Cisse had a huge game, as well as Isaac Likely. Even though Isaac Likely did not score at all, he was 0-4, the amount of times Likely was assisting different players, he recorded 6 assists in this game, and he's not a ball handler. He is not the point guard at all, but that just goes to show how great he was at finding his teammates in this game. He had so many good lobs over to Cisse, who had some big time plays coming off of an assist from Isaac Likely, and also the Boone twins. They both recorded double digits, 10 and 12 respectively. They just had that twin telepathy going. They were getting everything done that they wanted to. So strong in this game. And the score ended up being 64 to 55. There was at one point where there was a 6-point turnaround, and Oklahoma had gotten the game down to only one possession. They were only down by 3 points. I think around the 6-minute mark or something like that. And we're only down 3 points. Tanner Groves, their big scorer of the game, takes a shot from the perimeter, misses. Oklahoma State gets the ball back. And then on the offensive end, Oklahoma State, I'm pretty sure it was Cisse, went up for a layup, makes it, gets fouled on the way up, and it has an and-one opportunity that he converted, so a 6-point turnaround there. So at one point, Oklahoma was only down 6, then they were only down 3, then they became down by 6, and that was kind of a little bit jarring, and the team wasn't able to get the lead to be any smaller after that, and Oklahoma State just took away this game. And these are both teams that are kind of nearing the bottom of the conference. Both teams really needed this win. I think Oklahoma needed this win way more than Oklahoma State did, and they were just not able to get these plays done. Porter Moser in the post-game availability was very upset with the amount of turnovers and just bad decision-making that this team made down the stretch, and he was just really upset with how they handled themselves in transition. And I completely agree with him, because if Oklahoma stayed more poised through transition, they would have won this game, and they'd actually be a completely different team. Because it's okay if you don't shoot well from the perimeter. If you know that you don't do that, you need to make up for that in other areas. And everyone always talks about, you know, they're one of the best teams in the country in 2-point field goal percentage. Of course they are, because they can't shoot well from the perimeter, so where else are they going to make their shots? The only frustrating thing with them is that they can't capitalize on steals and turnovers that they cause on the defensive end, because they don't make their layups in transition. They can't pull up from 3 in transition and make those, which are big momentum shifts for teams. And when you don't make those small plays matter, they accumulate over time. And that's why Oklahoma State was able to take advantage of so many situations that Oklahoma fell on the wrong side of. So that's your wrap up for that. I know that was like a 10-minute wrap up, but just so many, I had so many thoughts on this game when I was watching it. But between two teams that probably needed some kind of a lift moving forward, Oklahoma definitely did, but did not receive it. They will be playing again on Wednesday. All right, and next we have Texas Tech and West Virginia. And I knew this game was going to get choppy, guys. I knew this game was going to get chippy, because that's what happens when you have a just incredible defensive team like Texas Tech going against such a another kind of bulldog-esque style of a team like West Virginia. And I know that the defense isn't where it used to be with Bob Huggins, but this team has still kept that fighter mentality in them. You can see it just in the way they play. So I knew this game was going to get chippy. And props to West Virginia for keeping this so close. And I mean, West Virginia started off with a bit of a lead for the majority of the first half. They built a little bit of a lead, and then Texas Tech would come back a bit, and then they built another lead, and Texas Tech would come back a bit. But Texas Tech did not really have control the entire first half, which I think is a big mental win for this team. And you can argue whether mental wins are real or not. That's a big discussion that's happening right now. But I think this is a big mental win for this West Virginia squad. You had McNeil really getting it done for this team. He had 15 points off of 4 of 16 shooting. And then Jalen Bridges, who had 16 points and shot 50% from the perimeter. He made the majority of their three-pointers. Sean made 2. And then no one else made any. So their whole percentage was based on basically 2 players, because almost no one else shot any besides a few bench players and then Johnson. But they don't have a deep enough roster to completely account for Texas Tech, especially when Texas Tech does so many fundamentally sound things right underneath the rim. They just beat you to death with scoring little by little and chopping away at it. And when you add their impenetrable defense to it, it's game over. That being said, though, the momentum that West Virginia was building in the first half was really, really good to see from this team, and also shows that Texas Tech isn't unbeatable. They've already beaten Baylor once. They've beaten Kansas once. But they're not unbeatable. And I think this is a good film for a lot of other teams in this conference to look and see what West Virginia was doing right in the first half and then apply it when they play Texas Tech again. So that'll be really helpful for a lot of teams. 3 players on Texas Tech's roster, or Texas Tech's starting 5, had double digits, including Williams, who had 15, Warren, who had 11, and McCuller, who had 10. So they're obviously, they're usually leading the scorers for this team. So that is to be expected. And then everything else was basically pretty straightforward as far as shooting goes. And I mean, turnovers were both kept to a minimum. Obviously, both of these teams take care of the ball very well. Texas Tech only had 12, and West Virginia only had 9. So really, they just couldn't get it done in the second half in terms of shooting. And when you have McNeil and Bridges making the majority of your points and literally no one else is contributing besides another player on the bench, like, you just can't get it done against this really good Texas Tech team, because in order to move that defense around a lot, you got to have a lot of offensive threats. And West Virginia just wasn't showing their offensive threats that game. So that one went to Tech. They should be going up in the rankings pretty soon because they beat 23-ranked Texas a few days earlier, and then they've also beaten West Virginia now. So I'm sure that they'll probably be breaking in the top 10. Baylor will be going down, as we saw Kansas just shoot the lights out of this Baylor team. And before I get into how well Kansas did, the argument keeps being flown around that this Baylor squad hasn't been at full strength and hasn't been, whenever they do get beat, it's because they're not at full strength. First of all, listen, there's a lot of teams in this country that are not at full strength based on the pandemic, based on injuries. It happens every single year. So you can't keep making that excuse for Baylor. I will say, though, it was so evident how badly Baylor was missing LJ Cryer in this game. They just didn't have that player bringing that spark off of the bench. They had no answer for Kansas. It was, I'm sorry, but like, listen, LJ Cryer is a great player, and they were definitely missing him, but they still had their starting 5. Their regular starting 5. So when you put that regular starting 5 against Kansas' starting 5, they should have been able to get something done eventually. And you could just tell Scott Drew was pissed about some no calls, which we'll get into, but pissed at his team, because Kansas, I know, was really, really trying to win the board battle, and they won it spectacularly. They almost out-rebounded Baylor by 10. They out-rebounded Baylor 46 to 37. And actually, Baylor did better than Kansas on rebounding offensive boards, getting those second chance opportunities. But Kansas out-rebounded them defensively, which is huge. They ended up out-rebounding them defensively 35 to 20. So they were taking away 15 more opportunities for Baylor to score. And that, I think, defined a lot of those moments early in the first half and then again early in the second half whenever they were fighting for these boards, making sure that Baylor didn't have any second chance shots, because that's really where Baylor's such an incredible team that it's not their only bread and butter, but one of their biggest bread and butters as a team is getting those second chance opportunities and immediately capitalizing on them. There is rare a time that Baylor gets a second chance shot that they don't make it. That's how good of a team that they are, that they're able to automatically make any of those second chance opportunities. And Bill Self, knowing that, made sure this team was prepared to battle on the boards. That's exactly what they did and what got them this win.
If you want to look the best heading into your sporting event, look no further, because Home Field Apparel has the best college apparel out there. The hoodies, the shirts, the tank tops, everything you need to look good, feel good, and to cheer on your team the way they deserve. Even if you're from your couch, they have the coziest hoodies. You guys won't want to miss out on this. Be sure to use code MIDWEST12 to get 15% off your first order.
That and freaking Christian Brown going off. Oh my gosh, I am such a fan of his. I'm pretty sure every fan base that plays against Kansas now hates this guy. And that is one of the best compliments you can get as a player, that your whole, like, KU's fan base loves him. Everybody else despises this guy. Whether it's because of his trash talk, his energy, the dunks, his defensive abilities, like, no matter what it is, they just don't like him. I love the energy he brings to this floor and this court. Like, we talk about Ochai Agbaji a lot, and rightfully so, because he has been known to be kind of the heartbeat of this team. He's able to really help calm them down, and just his presence on the floor is felt by everyone. But Christian Brown, when he makes a dunk, when he throws up a ball for another player's alley-oop, when he makes a defensive steal, like, he just brings this tenacious energy to this Kansas team that cannot be beaten. Like, he brings this energy that makes it so infectious for this team to just go along and battle with him. And just to read his stat line, I mean, he had 18 points on 8 of 14 shooting and 10 rebounds. So he actually recorded a double-double, and he led all scores along with Ochai, who also finished with 18. So Ochai barely almost made it to 20, which is his average, and had 9 rebounds. So both of the players almost had basically a double-double. Man, Christian Brown, he's another type of dude. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's another type of guy. And when he goes up for those dunks and you see him just look so dominant on the rim, I'm sorry. It just hits different. I can't even say why. It just hits different when Christian Brown dunks. And everyone for Kansas was contributing well. Their defensive rotations were so quick. Always in the right spot. You did catch them get out of rotation a little bit when Baylor would have a nice kick or really have a good chance at ball movement, but they were not shooting well at all. And I mean, it showed. They finished 25% from the perimeter and 30% from the field. And meanwhile, Kansas shot literally 51% from the field. So they made half of the shots they took, which is just insane. Goes to show you how well they were shooting as a team. And I mean, you might want to take out some of the players that came in for them in garbage time, but you really don't need to. It's not necessary. Like I said before, they really miss LJ Cryer, but you know who they actually really miss? James Akinjo. Yeah, James Akinjo was 0 of 11 from the field, 0 of 5 from the perimeter, did not make a single shot in his 24 minutes of playing time, and was not positive on the court. You almost forgot that Akinjo was there. You know, anytime he put up a shot and he missed, I was like, I wonder what else he shot tonight. And I would look and he hadn't made any. And I was just waiting for him to come alive for this Baylor team. They needed him to resuscitate this offense. And he just was nowhere to be found. You could not find a pulse in this Baylor team. Anytime they would gain any kind of a small little run here or there, Kansas just quickly doused it. And that being said, though, that's not the Baylor team that we're used to seeing. And the question is how do they respond to this loss? And I think that's kind of the feeling of everyone in this conference, because now Kansas's record is sitting at 8-1. Baylor's is now 7-3, as well as Texas Tech's. So they are now, Kansas is now two games ahead of all the other teams in this conference. So you're looking at Baylor, and it's really how do they respond to this loss? Because you can hang your head and say, look, we got Kansas State coming up. We should probably beat them. But like we've talked about before on this podcast, Kansas State is the real deal, guys. Like, they are not a team to be messed with. You don't want to go into Manhattan thinking, oh, this is going to be an easy win, because it's, I mean, they literally almost beat Kansas just a few weeks prior. So you can't just go waltz in there thinking that that game is guaranteed, because no games are guaranteed, but definitely not against this gritty Kansas State team. And then they have Texas the following Saturday, and that one will be in Waco, but they have gotten beaten in Waco a few times, so that's not really saying much. But after that, they have Texas Tech, and then they will play Kansas again late in February. So they still have a lot of matchups left to make up for this. And only three losses in conference play is still huge. And if they win out, who knows what could happen? Kansas could have this big dominant performance against Baylor, for instance, and then think, oh, well, we've got this conference on wrap. Not really, because they're only, them and Texas Tech are only two games behind you. So it really just matters on how these two teams respond to this kind of a performance, because you could see Kansas become lackadaisical and then end up losing in Waco later, or you could see Texas Tech really start taking strides. And if they beat Baylor again, they're stealing Baylor's spot. So it really just depends on how Baylor handles that Texas Tech win, or Texas Tech game coming up, and then how they handle Kansas later on, as well as finishing out against TCU, who we've said is pretty good. Texas Tech can turn on a dime. Texas can turn on a dime. Kansas State isn't a team to ignore. And then they also play Texas again in late February again. So there's still a lot of games left on their schedule to kind of help bring them back up. And I say bring them back up, they're like ranked third in the conference right now. So, but yeah, like I said, they're going to definitely be going down in the rankings, especially when Kansas beat them by practically 30. The only reason why it came down to 24 was because all the reserves went in, and it was at that point just, okay. You know, it was just like, we're just playing now to play. So it was basically, they were basically down by 30 the majority of the second half. So it really is about how they respond. Baylor needs to do the same thing that Kansas did when they lost really bad to Kentucky, which is just throw away the tape, because we both know that that's not what Baylor's identity is, and that wasn't what Kansas' identity was. So these are just tapes that you should just take out and throw away. This isn't one that Scott Drew should take out and throw away, though, because he needs to dissect what this Kansas team did to them to make them pay the way that they paid, so that whenever they do play Kansas once again, they know exactly what they need to hit to make sure that they stop Kansas, aka don't let Christian Brown dunk and win the boards. But I'm not going to say that it's that simple, because it's not. But that was just incredible. And the implications of this game moving forward is just what's going to be interesting in this Big 12 slate. But you guys, we got ourselves a little bit of an upset happening. That's right. Texas beat Iowa State 63-41, very handily, a 22-point win for Texas, who is ranked 23, Iowa State ranked 20. I don't know whether or not this means that Iowa State will be out of the top 25. I think that since Texas is ranked 23, I think that they'll probably be around the 24 area. I don't think that teams are going to be willing to completely knock out Iowa State. But I mean, this game was really just Texas's to win. We finally saw them have a really, really good shooting night, which was a long time coming, to be honest with you. And Iowa State could not make anything. They shot even worse than Baylor did. They only finished 13% from the perimeter, 28% from the field, and it was just a sad showing by them. They only had 8 points coming off of the bench and 2 players on their roster that hit double digits. Of course, Isaiah Brockington was one of those. He had 12 points off of 5 of 17 shooting. One of the only players to shoot in double figures on attempts. Literally the only player that shot in double figures in attempts and had 8 rebounds. And then you had Hunter, who finished 4 of 9 from the floor. Gotta love that efficiency. With 7 rebounds and 10 points. So he was their big time player in this game, but nobody else showed up for Iowa State. And then you got Texas, who really just showed out well. You had Christian Bishop, who I think is now really starting to hit his stride with his team and knowing where his spots are. And I mean, I just said that Hunter was efficient. You look at Christian Bishop's efficiency. He shot 5 of 7 from the floor and finished with 10 points. He only missed 2 shots the whole game. Finished with 7 rebounds too. And then Marcus Carr ended up 50% from the floor and 50% from 3. So he was 6 of 12 from the floor, 2 of 4 from the perimeter, and had 14 points as well as 8 assists. So he did a really good job of distributing, getting the offense flowing through him, but also finding his own shot too, which is really hard to balance, I think, in college basketball and on this Texas team that's not really used to playing together that much. Also, we just have to really talk about how good Andrew Jones was coming off the bench for Texas this weekend. I mean, he just added so much spark to the secondary rotation. He was 5 of 10 from the field, 4 of 7 from 3. So that means he was only 1 of 3 from the field without the perimeter shooting, and finished with 14 points and was also one of the main contributors to why Texas won this game, putting him in with the rest of the bench. This Texas bench outscored Iowa State 22-8. I mean, I'm sorry. I'm sure that I sound like a broken record right now, but you cannot underestimate deep rosters in this league. You just can't. And if you don't have a deep roster, and if you're not like a Scott Drew Baylor team that has LJ Cryer, where you guys are shooting well and you can afford to only play 3 players off the bench and be fine, you're just not going to win a lot of games. You have to have your bench contributing as much as possible. You have to be like Oklahoma State that had 26 bench points. You have to be like Texas in this game, who had 22 points coming off of the bench. That is such a powerful thing in this league, and that's what gets a lot of these teams through gritty wins like this one. So that's my big takeaway from this Texas game. And then last but certainly not least, we have Kansas playing TCU. This was such a strong win for Kansas State because we said it before in this podcast. I've said it with Colin Post, who we've had on here before, who covers TCU. This team should not be underestimated by any means. They're so underrated. They're near the middle of the Big 12 right now, so their record is so strong right now that they're making a really, really good run as to why they should be a mid-tier tournament team. And so this was a really strong win for Kansas State, one they definitely needed. And this was a pretty competitive game, I want to say. I mean, Kansas State finished with 75 points, TCU with 63. They don't usually shoot above the 70s, but they usually remain around that 60 range. So it's nothing short of what we're used to seeing from this TCU team. But for Kansas State to finish with 75 points and, you know, almost a third, honestly, came from Pack, who was 7 of 10 from the field. He shot 50% from the perimeter, 3 of 6, by the way, and had 20 total points. So he almost scored a third of what the team finished with, that's like Ochai Agbaji numbers. He had himself a game. And then Noel finished with 14 points on 5 of 15 shooting. Smith ended up with 16 on 5 of 12 shooting, almost 50%. And then you have McGurl, who finished 4 of 10 from the floor, 3 of 5 respectively from the 3-point range. He was more efficient than Pack was. And he had, I think that's 60% from the perimeter, finishing with 13 points there. So that's 4 players for the Wildcats that were in double figures, and their bench had 8 points, whereas TCU's bench only had 2. The bench for TCU combined for a bucket. Yeah, I left that pause in there for dramatic effect. That is just unacceptable. Unacceptable in this league. You cannot expect to win any games with having a bucket from your bench to show for it. That is just not going to win you any games. And so it was just definitely in the Wildcats' hands at that point when you have such a terrible bench production coming off of TCU in this game. And they kept the turnovers equal at 14 each. So that's it. That's all you got to do, you know? Like, don't have your bench only score a bucket, because there will be practically nothing to show for that. Or just a loss, actually. But that is the wrap-up of this weekend for Big 12 men's basketball. We will have so much more coming up soon, so much more to dive into. And like I said before, just the implications now of these teams starting to really show themselves is going to mean a lot moving forward. Around this time is when teams are starting to become seriously looked at for seedings. Like, yes, we've seen bracketology stuff all season long, but it is so variable and it moves so many times. But now is when teams have really solidified their identity and a lot of what their winning percentage is. So this is really, these wins now are going to mean a lot more than they did back in January. In January, you can say, oh, it's a long season. We have a game in a few days. This one won't really matter that much because we have so many more games. No, now it's the point where every win is going to be so much more closely looked at than they were before. So, I mean, props to Kansas for getting a good win at a really specific time where teams are starting to become seriously looked at for seeding. And Baylor has a chance to respond to that. TCU is in a good placement right now. Unfortunately for Oklahoma State, this isn't really relevant for them, but man, they'd be such an interesting tournament team if they were given that opportunity. But there's so much more to get into, like I said, and we're going to continue to build on this moving forward, continue to look at teams more critically, and really just keep following the best basketball league in the country. But that has been Midwest Madness. Please follow us on Twitter at MW_MadnessBig12. Follow myself at CB on Sports, as well as follow the network at the 1012 Network on Twitter, because that way you can follow all the podcasts. Like, if you want to just listen to Baylor stuff, we have a Between the Bears podcast. We have a new Iowa State specific podcast, the Cyclones Family, and so much more great content that you can find there. So be sure to follow all of us on Twitter to stay updated with all of your basketball stuff, with all of your Big 12 stuff. We have you covered better than literally anyone else. I don't care what you say. Anyways, we'll catch you guys next time.
Sports Social Podcast Network.